Side 3, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 76. He groped for the stein, raised it, and drank a third of it. Frozen, Ricky Lee watched his Adam's apple go up and down. Hanscom set the stein aside, shuddered twice, then nodded. He looked at Ricky Lee and smiled a little. His eyes were no longer red. Works about like they said it did. You are so fucking concerned about your nose that you never feel what's going down your throat at all. You're crazy, Mr. Hanscom, Ricky Lee said. You bet your fur, Mr. Hanscom said. You remember that one, Ricky Lee? We used to say that when we were kids. You bet your fur. Did I ever tell you I used to be fat? No, sir, you never did, Ricky Lee whispered. He was now convinced that Mr. Hanscom had received some intelligence so dreadful that the man really had gone crazy, or at least taken temporary leave of his senses. I was a regular butterball. Never played baseball or basketball. Always got caught first when we played tag. Couldn't keep out of my own way. I was fat, all right. And there were these fellows in my hometown who used to take after me pretty regularly. There was a fellow named Reginald Huggins, only everyone called him Belch. A kid named Victor Chris, a few other guys. But the real brains of the combination was a fellow named Henry Bowers. If there has ever been a genuinely evil kid strutting across the skin of the world, Ricky Lee, Henry Bowers was that kid. I wasn't the only kid he used to take after. My problem was, I couldn't run as fast as some of the others. Hanscom unbuttoned his shirt and opened it. Leaning forward, Ricky Lee saw a funny twisted scar on Mr. Hanscom's stomach, just above his navel. Puckered, white, and old. It was a letter, he saw. Someone had carved the letter H into the man's stomach, probably long before Mr. Hanscom had been a man. Henry Bowers did that to me, about 1,000 years ago. I'm lucky I'm not wearing his whole damn name down there. Mr. Hanscom? Hanscom took the other two lemon slices, one in each hand, tilted his head back, and took them like nose drops. He shuddered rackingly, put them aside, and took two big swallows from the stein. He shuddered again, took another gulp, and then groped for the padded edge of the bar with his eyes closed. For a moment he held on like a man on a sailboat clinging to the rail for support in a heavy sea. Then he opened his eyes again and smiled at Ricky Lee. I could ride this bull all night, he said. Mr. Hanscom, I wish you wouldn't do that anymore, Ricky Lee said nervously. Annie came over to the waitress's stand with her tray and called for a couple of millers. Ricky Lee drew them and took them down to her. His legs felt rubbery. Is Mr. Hanscom all right, Ricky Lee? Annie asked. She was looking past Ricky Lee, and he turned to follow her gaze. Mr. Hanscom was leaning over the bar, carefully picking lemon slices out of the caddy where Ricky Lee kept the drink garnishes. I don't know, he said. I don't think so. Well, get your thumb out of your ass and do something about it. Annie was, like most other women, partial to Ben Hanscom. I don't know. My daddy always said that if a man's in his right mind... Your daddy didn't have the brains God gave a gopher, Annie said. Never mind your daddy. You've got to put a stop to that, Ricky Lee. He's going to kill himself. Thus given his marching orders, Ricky Lee went back down to where Ben Hanscom sat. Mr. Hanscom, I really think you've had an... Hanscom tilted his head back, squeezed, actually sniffed the lemon juice back this time, as if it were cocaine. He gulped whiskey as if it were water. He looked at Ricky Lee solemnly. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug, he said, and then laughed. There was maybe 2 inches of whiskey left in the stein. That is enough, Ricky Lee said and reached for the stein. Hanscom moved it gently out of his reach. Damage has been done, Ricky Lee, he said. The damage has been done, boy. Mr. Hanscom, please. I've got something for your kids, Ricky Lee. Damn if I didn't almost forget. He was wearing a faded denim vest, and now he reached something out of one of its pockets. Ricky Lee heard a muted clink. My dad died when I was 4, Hanscom said. There was no slur at all in his voice. Left us a bunch of debts and these... I want your kiddos to have them, Ricky Lee. He put 3 cartwheel silver dollars on the bar where they gleamed under the soft lights. Ricky Lee caught his breath. Mr. Hanscom, that's very kind, but I couldn't. There used to be 4, but I gave one of them to Stuttering Bill and the others. Bill Denbro, that was his real name. Stuttering Bill's just what we used to call him, just a thing we used to say, like, you bet your fur. He was one of the best friends I ever had. I did have a few, you know. Even a fat kid like me had a few. Stuttering Bill's a writer now. Ricky Lee barely heard him. He was looking at the cartwheels, fascinated. 1921, 1923, and 1924. God knew what they were worth now, just in terms of the pure silver they contained. I couldn't, he said again. But I insist. Mr. Hanscom took hold of the stein and drained it. He should have been flat on his keister, but his eyes never left Ricky Lee's. Those eyes were watery and very bloodshot, but Ricky Lee would have sworn on a stack of Bibles that they were also the eyes of a sober man. You're scaring me a little, Mr. Hanscom, Ricky Lee said. 2 years ago, Gresham Arnold, a rum-dum of some local repute, had come into the Red Wheel with a roll of quarters in his hand and a $20 bill stuck into the band of his hat. He handed the roll to Annie with instructions to feed the quarters into the jukebox by fours. He put the 20 on the bar and instructed Ricky Lee to set up drinks for the house. This rum-dum, this Gresham Arnold, had long ago been a star basketball player for the Hemmingford Rams, leading them to their first, and most likely last, high school team championship. In 1961 that had been. An almost unlimited future seemed to lie ahead of the young man. But he had flunked out of LSU his first semester, a victim of drink, drugs, and all-night parties. He came home, cracked up the yellow convertible his folks had given him as a graduation present, and got a job as head salesman at his daddy's John Deere dealership. 5 years passed. His father could not bear to fire him, and so he finally sold the dealership and retired to Arizona, a man haunted and made old before his time by the inexplicable and apparently irreversible degeneration of his son. While the dealership still belonged to his daddy and he was at least pretending to work, Arnold had made some effort to keep the booze at arm's length. Afterward, it got him completely. He could get mean, but he had been just as sweet as whorehound candy the night he brought in the quarters and set up drinks for the house, and everyone had thanked him kindly, and Annie kept playing Mo Bandy songs because Gresham Arnold liked old Mo Bandy. He sat there at the bar, on the very stool where Mr. Hanscom was sitting now, Ricky Lee realized with steadily deepening unease, and drank three or four bourbon and bitters, and sang along with the juke and caused no trouble, and went home when Ricky Lee closed the wheel up, and hanged himself with his belt in an upstairs closet. Gresham Arnold's eyes that night had looked a little bit like Ben Hanscom's eyes look right now. "Scaring you a bit, am I?" Hanscom asked, his eyes never leaving Ricky Lee's. He pushed the stein away and then folded his hands neatly in front of those three silver cartwheels. "I probably am. But you're not as scared as I am, Ricky Lee. Pray to Jesus you never are." "Well, what's the matter?" Ricky Lee asked. "Maybe," he wet his lips, "maybe I can give you a help." "The matter?" Ben Hanscom laughed. "Why, not too much. I had a call from an old friend tonight, a guy named Mike Hanlon. I'd forgotten all about him, Ricky Lee, but that didn't scare me much. After all, I was just a kid when I knew him, and kids forget things, don't they?" "Sure they do. You bet your fur. What scared me was getting about halfway over here and realizing that it wasn't just Mike I'd forgotten about. I'd forgotten everything about being a kid." Ricky Lee only looked at him. He had no idea what Mr. Hanscom was talking about. But the man was scared, all right. No question about that. It sat funny on Ben Hanscom, but it was real. "I mean I'd forgotten all about it," he said, and rapped his knuckles lightly on the bar for emphasis. "Did you ever hear, Ricky Lee, of having an amnesia so complete you didn't even know you had amnesia?" Ricky Lee shook his head. "Me either. But there I was, tooling along in the caddy tonight, and all of a sudden it hit me. I remembered Mike Hanlon, but only because he called me on the phone. I remembered Derry, but only because that was where he was calling from." "Derry?" "But that was all. It hit me that I hadn't even thought about being a kid since I don't even know when. And then, just like that, it all started to flood back in, like what we did with the fourth silver dollar." "What did you do with it, Mr. Hanscom?" Hanscom looked at his watch and suddenly slipped down from his stool. He staggered a bit, the slightest bit. That was all. "Can't let the time get away from me," he said. "I'm flying tonight." Ricky Lee looked instantly alarmed, and Hanscom laughed. flying but not driving the plane. Not this time. United Airlines, Ricky Lee. Oh. He supposed his relief showed on his face, but he didn't care. Where are you going? Hanscom's shirt was still open. He looked thoughtfully down at the puckered white lines of the old scar on his belly and then began to button the shirt over it. Thought I told you that, Ricky Lee. Home. I'm going home. Give those cartwheels to your kids. He started toward the door, and something about the way he walked, even the way he hitched at the sides of his pants, terrified Ricky Lee. The resemblance to the late and mostly unlamented Gresham Arnold was suddenly so acute it was nearly like seeing a ghost. "Mr. Hanscom!" he cried in alarm. Hanscom turned back, and Ricky Lee stepped quickly backward. His ass hit the back bar, and glassware gossiped briefly as the bottles knocked together. He stepped back because he was suddenly convinced that Ben Hanscom was dead. Yes, Ben Hanscom was lying dead someplace, in a ditch or an attic, or possibly in a closet with a belt noosed around his neck and the toes of his $400 cowboy boots dangling an inch or two above the floor. And this thing standing near the juke and staring back at him was a ghost. For a moment, just a moment, but it was plenty long enough to cover his working heart with a rime of ice. He was convinced he could see tables and chairs right through the man. What is it, Ricky Lee? Nothing. Ben Hanscom looked out at Ricky Lee from eyes which had dark purple crescents beneath them. His cheeks burned with liquor. His nose looked red and sore. Nothing, Ricky Lee whispered again. But he couldn't take his eyes from that face. The face of a man who has died deep in sin and now stands hard by hell's smoking side door. I was fat and we were poor, Ben Hanscom said. I remember that now. And I remember that either a girl named Beverly or Stuttering Bill saved my life with a silver dollar. I'm scared, almost insane by whatever else I may remember before tonight's over. But how scared I am doesn't matter. Because it's going to come anyway. It's all there. Like a great big bubble that's growing in my mind. But I'm going, because all I've ever gotten and all I have now is somehow due to what we did then. And you pay for what you get in this world. Maybe that's why God made us kids first and built us close to the ground. Because he knows you got to fall down a lot and bleed a lot before you learn that one simple lesson. You pay for what you get. You own what you pay for. And sooner or later, whatever you own comes back home to you. You gonna be back this weekend, though, ain't you? Ricky Lee asked through numbed lips. In his increasing distress, this was all he could find to hold on to. You gonna be back this weekend just like always, ain't you? I don't know, Mr. Hanscom said, and smiled a terrible smile. I'm going a lot farther than London this time, Ricky Lee. Mr. Hanscom! You give those cartwheels to your kids, he repeated, and slipped out into the night. What the blue hell? Annie asked, but Ricky Lee ignored her. He flipped up the bar's partition and ran over to one of the windows which looked out on the parking lot. He saw the headlights of Mr. Hanscom's caddy come on, heard the engine rev. It pulled out of the dirt lot, kicking up a rooster tail of dust behind it. The taillights dwindled away to red points down Highway 63, and the Nebraska night wind began to pull the hanging dust apart. He took on a boxcar full of booze, and you let him get in that big car of his and drive away, Annie said. Way to go, Ricky Lee. Never mind. He's going to kill himself. And although this had been Ricky Lee's own thought less than 5 minutes ago, he turned to her when the taillights winked out of sight and shook his head. I don't think so, he said. Although the way he looked tonight, it might be better for him if he did. What did he say to you? He shook his head. It was all confused in his mind, and the sum total of it seemed to mean nothing. It doesn't matter, but I don't think we're ever going to see that old boy again. 4. Eddie Casbrack takes his medicine. If you would know all there is to know about an American man or woman in the middle class as the millennium nears its end, you would need only to look in his or her medicine cabinet. Or so it has been said. But, dear Lord, get a look into this one as Eddie Capsbrack slides it open, mercifully sliding aside his white face and wide staring eyes. On the top shelf, there's Anacin, Excedrin, Excedrin PM, Contac, Gelusil, Tylenol, and a large blue jar of Vicks, looking like a bit of brooding deep twilight under glass. There is a bottle of Vivarin, a bottle of Serutan. That's nature's spelled backwards, the ads on Lawrence Welk used to say when Eddie Capsbrack was but a wee slip of a lad. And two bottles of Phillips Milk of Magnesia, the regular, which tastes like liquid chalk, and the new mint flavor, which tastes like mint-flavored liquid chalk. Here is a large bottle of Rolaid standing chummily close to a large bottle of Tums. The Tums are standing next to a large bottle of orange-flavored Digel tablets. The three of them look like a trio of strange piggy banks stuffed with pills instead of dimes. Second shelf and dig the Vites. You got your E, your C with rose hips. You got B simple and B complex and B12. There's L-lysine, which is supposed to do something about those embarrassing skin problems. And lecithin, which is supposed to do something about that embarrassing cholesterol buildup in and around the big pump. There's iron, calcium, and cod liver oil. There's one-a-day multiples, Myodec multiples, Centrum multiples. And sitting up on top of the cabinet itself is a gigantic bottle of Geritol, just for good measure. Moving right along to Eddie's third shelf, we find the utility infielders of the patent medicine world. X-Lax, Carter's Little Pills. Those two keep Eddie Capsbrack moving the mail. Here nearby is Kaopectate, Pepto-Bismol, and Preparation H in case the mail moves too fast or too painfully. Also some tucks in a screw-top jar just to keep everything tidy after the mail has gone through, be it just an advertising circular or two addressed to occupant or a big old special delivery package. Here is Formula 44 for coughs, NyQuil and Dristan for colds, and a big bottle of castor oil. There's a tin of Sucrets in case Eddie's throat gets sore, and there's a quartet of mouthwashes. Chloraseptic, Cepacol, Cepastat in the spray bottle, and of course good old Listerine, often imitated but never duplicated. Visine and Murine for the eyes, Cordate and Neosporin ointment for the skin. The second line of defense if the L-lysine doesn't live up to expectations. A tube of Oxy-5 and a plastic bottle of Oxy-Wash, because Eddie would definitely rather have a few less cents than a few more zits, and some tetracycline pills. And off to one side, clustered like bitter conspirators, are three bottles of Coal Tar shampoo. The bottom shelf is almost deserted, but the stuff which is here means serious business. You could cruise on this stuff, okay? On this stuff, you could fly higher than Ben Hanscom's jet and crash harder than Thurman Munson's. There's Valium, Percodan, Elevil, and Darvon Complex. There is also another Sucrets box on this low shelf, but there are no Sucrets in it. If you open that one, you would find six Quaaludes. Eddie Capsbrack believed in the Boy Scout motto. He was swinging a blue tote bag as he came into the bathroom. He set it on the sink, unzipped it, and then with trembling hands he began to spill bottles and jars and tubes and squeeze bottles and spray bottles into it. Under other circumstances, he would have taken them out handful by careful handful, but there was no time for such niceties now. The choice, as Eddie saw it, was as simple as it was brutal. Get moving and keep moving, or stand in one place long enough to start thinking about what all of this meant and simply die of fright. Eddie? Myra called from downstairs. Eddie, what are you doing? Eddie dropped the Sucrets box containing the lewds into the bag. The medicine cabinet was now entirely empty except for Myra's Midol and a small, almost used-up tube of Blistex. He paused for a moment and then grabbed the Blistex. He started to zip the bag closed, debated, and then threw in the Midol as well. She could always buy more. Eddie! From halfway up the stairs now. Eddie zipped the bag the rest of the way closed and then left the bathroom, swinging it by his side. He was a short man with a timid, rabbity sort of face. Much of his hair was gone. What was left grew in listless, piebald patches. The weight of the bag pulled him noticeably to one side. An extremely large woman was climbing slowly to the second floor. Eddie could hear the stairs creak protestingly under her. "What are you doing?" Eddie did not need a shrink to tell him that he had, in a sense, married his mother. Myra Capsbrack was huge. She had only been big when Eddie married her 5 years ago, but he sometimes thought his subconscious had seen the potential for hugeness in her. God knew his own mother had been a whopper. And she looked somehow more huge than ever as she reached the second floor landing. She was wearing a white nightgown which swelled comber-like at bosom and hip. Her face, devoid of makeup, was white and shiny. She looked badly frightened.
"I have to go away for a while," Eddie said.
"What do you mean you have to go away?
What was that telephone call?"
"Nothing," he said, fleeing abruptly down the hallway to their walk-in closet. He put the tote bag down, opened the closet's fold-back door, and raked aside the half-dozen identical black suits which hung there, as conspicuous as a thundercloud among the other more brightly colored clothes. He always wore one of the black suits when he was working. He bent into the closet, smelled mothballs and wool, and pulled out one of the suitcases from the back. He opened it and began throwing clothes in. Her shadow fell over him.
"What's this about, Eddie? Where are you going? You tell me."
"I can't tell you." She stood there, watching him, trying to decide what to say next or what to do. The thought of simply bundling him into the closet and then standing with her back against the door until this madness had passed crossed her mind. But she was unable to bring herself to do it, although she certainly could have. She was 3 inches taller than Eddie and outweighed him by 100 pounds. She couldn't think of what to do or say, because this was so utterly unlike him. She could not have been any more dismayed and frightened if she had walked into the television room and found their new big-screen TV floating in the air.
"You can't go," she heard herself saying. "You promised you'd get me Al Pacino's autograph."
It was an absurdity, God knew it was, but at this point even an absurdity was better than nothing.
"You'll still get it," Eddie said. "You'll have to drive him yourself."
Oh, here was a new terror to join those already circling in her poor dazzled head. She uttered a small scream.
"I can't. I never..."
"You'll have to," he said. He was examining his shoes now. "There's no one else."
"Neither of my uniforms fit anymore. They're too tight in the tits."
"Have Dolores let one of them out," he said implacably. He threw 2 pairs of shoes back, found an empty shoebox, and popped a 3rd pair into it. Good black shoes, plenty of use left in them still, but looking just a bit too worn to wear on the job. When you drove rich people around New York for a living, many of them famous rich people, everything had to look just right. These shoes no longer looked just right, but he supposed they would do for where he was going, and for whatever he might have to do when he got there.
Maybe Richie Tozier would.
But then the blackness threatened and he felt his throat beginning to close up. Eddie realized with real panic that he had packed the whole damn drugstore and had left the most important thing of all, his aspirator, downstairs on top of the stereo cabinet. He banged the suitcase closed and latched it. He looked around at Myra, who was standing there in the hallway with her hand pressed against the short, thick column of her neck as if she were the one with the asthma. She was staring at him, her face full of perplexity and terror. And he might have felt sorry for her if his heart had not already been so filled with terror for himself.
"What's happened, Eddie? Who is that on the telephone? Are you in trouble?" "You are, aren't you? What kind of trouble are you in?"
He walked toward her, zipper bag in one hand and suitcase in the other, standing more or less straight now that he was more evenly weighted. She moved in front of him, blocking off the stairway. And at first he thought she would not give way. Then, when his face was about to crash into the soft roadblock of her breasts, she did give way, fearfully. As he walked past, never slowing, she burst into miserable tears.
"I can't drive, Al Pacino," she bawled. "I'll smash into a stop sign or something. I know I will. Eddie, I'm scared."
He looked at the Seth Thomas clock on the table by the stairs. 9:20. The canned-sounding Delta clerk had told him he had already missed the last flight north to Maine. That one had left LaGuardia at 8:25. He had called Amtrak and discovered there was a late train to Boston departing Penn Station at 11:30. It would drop him off at South Station, where he could take a cab to the offices of Cape Cod Limousine on Arlington Street. Cape Cod and Eddie's company, Royal Crest, had worked out a useful and friendly reciprocal arrangement over the years. A quick call to Butch Carrington in Boston had taken care of his transportation north. Butch said he would have a Cadillac limo gassed and ready for him. So he would go in style, and with no pain-in-the-ass client sitting in the back seat, stinking the air up with a big cigar and asking if Eddie knew where he could score a broad or a few grams of coke or both.
"Going in style, all right," he thought. Only way you could go in more style would be if you were going in a hearse. But don't worry, Eddie. That's probably how you'll come back. If there's enough of you left to pick up, that is. Eddie?
9:20. Plenty of time to talk to her. Plenty of time to be kind. Ah, but it would have been so much better if this had been her whist night. If he could have just slipped out, leaving a note under one of the magnets on the refrigerator door. The refrigerator door was where he left all his notes for Myra, because there she never missed them. Leaving that way, like a fugitive, would not have been good, but this was even worse. This was like having to leave home all over again, and that had been so hard he'd had to do it 3 times. Sometimes home is where the heart is, Eddie thought randomly. I believe that. Old Bobby Frost said home's the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. Unfortunately, it's also the place where, once you're in there, they don't ever want to let you out. He stood at the head of the stairs, forward motion temporarily spent, filled with fear, breath wheezing noisily in and out of the pinhole his throat had become, and regarded his weeping wife.
Come on downstairs with me and I'll tell you what I can, he said.
Eddie put his 2 bags, clothes in one, medicine in the other, by the door in the front hall. He remembered something else then, or rather the ghost of his mother, who had been dead many years, but who still spoke frequently in his mind, remembered for him.
You know when your feet get wet, you always get a cold, Eddie. You're not like other people. You have a very weak system. You have to be careful. That's why you must always wear your rubbers when it rains.
It rained a lot in Derry. Eddie opened the front hall closet, got his rubbers off the hook where they hung neatly in a plastic bag, and put them in his clothes suitcase.
That's a good boy, Eddie.
He and Myra had been watching TV when the shit hit the fan. Eddie went into the television room and pushed the button which lowered the screen of the Murovision TV. Its screen was so big that it made Freeman McNeil look like a visitor from Brobdingnag on Sunday afternoons. He picked up the telephone and called a taxi. The dispatcher told him it would probably be 15 minutes. Eddie said that was no problem. He hung up and grabbed his aspirator off the top of their expensive Sony compact disc player.
I spent $1,500 on a state-of-the-art sound system so that Myra wouldn't miss a single golden note on her Barry Manilow records and her Supremes' greatest hits, he thought, and then felt a flush of guilt. That wasn't fair, and he damn well knew it. Myra would have been just as happy with her old scratchy records as she was with the new 45 RPM-sized laser discs. Just as she would have been happy to keep on living in the little four-room house in Queens until they were both old and gray. And, if the truth were told, there was a little snow on Eddie Casbrack's mountain already. He had bought the luxury sound system for the same reasons that he had bought this low fieldstone house on Long Island, where the two of them often rattled around like the last 2 peas in a can, because he had been able to, and because they were ways of appeasing the soft, frightened, often bewildered, always implacable voice of his mother. They were ways of saying, I made it, Ma. Look at all this. I made it. Now will you please, for Christ's sake, shut up a while?
Eddie stuffed the aspirator into his mouth and, like a man miming suicide, pulled the trigger. A cloud of awful licorice taste roiled and boiled its way down his throat, and Eddie breathed deeply. He could feel breathing passages which had almost closed start to open up again. The tightness in his chest started to ease, and suddenly he heard voices in his mind, ghost voices.
Didn't you get the note I sent you? I got it, Mrs. Casbrack, but... Well, in case you can't read, Coach Black, let me tell you in person. Are you ready?
Mrs. Casbrack.
Good, here it comes, from my lips to your ears. Ready? My Eddie cannot take physical education. I repeat, he cannot take phys ed. Eddie is very delicate, and if he runs or jumps...
Mrs. Casbrack, I have the results of Eddie's last physical on file in my office. That's a state requirement. It says that Eddie is a little small for his age, but otherwise he's absolutely normal. So I called your family physician just to be sure, and he confirmed.
Are you saying I'm a liar, Coach Black? Is that it? Well, here he is. Here's Eddie standing right beside me. Can you hear the way he's breathing? Can you?
Mom, please, I'm all right.
Eddie, you know better than that. I taught you better than that. Don't interrupt your elders.
I hear him, Mrs. Casbrack, but...
Do you? Good. I thought maybe you were deaf. He sounds like a truck going uphill in low gear, doesn't he? And if that isn't asthma...
Mom, I'll be...
Be quiet, Eddie. Don't interrupt me again. If that isn't asthma, Coach Black, then I'm Queen Elizabeth. Mrs. Kasprak, Eddie often seems very well and happy in his physical education classes. He loves to play games, and he runs quite fast. In my conversation with Dr. Baines, the word psychosomatic came up. I wonder if you've considered the possibility that...
That my son is crazy? Is that what you're trying to say? Are you trying to say that my son is crazy?
No, but...
He's delicate.
Mrs. Kasprak.
My son is very delicate.
Mrs. Kasprak, Dr. Baines confirmed that he could find nothing at all.
Physically wrong, Eddie finished.
The memory of that humiliating encounter, his mother screaming at Coach Black in the Derry Elementary School gymnasium while he gasped and cringed at her side, and the other kids huddled around one of the baskets and watched, had recurred to him tonight for the first time in years. Nor was that the only memory which Mike Hanlon's call was going to bring back, he knew. He could feel many others, as bad or even worse, crowding and jostling like sale-mad shoppers bottlenecked in a department store doorway. But soon the bottleneck would break, and they would be along. He was quite sure of that. And what would they find on sale? His sanity? Could be. Half price. Smoke and water damage. Everything must go.
Nothing physically wrong, he repeated, took a deep, shuddery breath, and stuffed the aspirator into his pocket.
Eddie, Myra said, please tell me what all of this is about.
Tear tracks shone on her chubby cheeks. Her hands twisted restlessly together like a pair of pink and hairless animals at play. Once, shortly before actually proposing marriage, he had taken a picture of Myra, which she had given him, and had put it next to one of his mother, who had died of congestive heart failure at the age of 64. At the time of her death, Eddie's mother had topped the scales at over 400 pounds, 406 to be exact. She had become something nearly monstrous by then. Her body had seemed nothing more than boobs and butt and belly, all overtopped by her pasty, perpetually dismayed face. But the picture of her which he put next to Myra's picture had been taken in 1944, 2 years before he had been born.
You were a very sickly baby, the ghost mom now whispered in his ear. Many times we despaired of your life.
In 1944, his mother had been a relatively svelte 180 pounds. He had made that comparison, he supposed, in a last-ditch effort to stop himself from committing psychological incest. He looked from mother to Myra, and back again to mother. They could have been sisters. The resemblance was that close. Eddie looked at the two nearly identical pictures and promised himself he would not do this crazy thing. He knew that the boys at work were already making jokes about Jack Spratt and his wife. But they didn't know the half of it. The jokes and snide remarks he could take. But did he really want to be a clown in such a Freudian circus as this? No, he did not. He would break it off with Myra. He would let her down gently because she was really very sweet and had had even less experience with men than he'd had with women. And then, after she had finally sailed over the horizon of his life, he could maybe take those tennis lessons he'd been thinking of for such a long time. Eddie often seems very well and happy in his physical education classes. Or there were the pool memberships they were selling at the UN Plaza Hotel. Eddie loves to play games. Not to mention that health club which had opened up on 3rd Avenue across from the garage.
Eddie runs quite fast. He runs quite fast when you're not here. Runs quite fast when there's nobody around to remind him of how delicate he is. And I see in his face, Mrs. Kasprak, that he knows even now, at the age of 9, he knows that the biggest favor in the world he could do himself would be to run fast in any direction. You're not going to let him go, Mrs. Kasprak. Let him run.
But in the end, he had married Myra anyway. In the end, the old ways and the old habits had simply been too strong. Home was the place where, when you have to go there, they have to chain you up. Oh, he might have beaten his mother's ghost. It would have been hard, but he was quite sure he could have done that much, if that had been all which needed doing. It was Myra herself who had ended up tipping the scales away from independence. Myra had condemned him with solicitude, had nailed him with concern, had chained him with sweetness. Myra, like his mother, had reached the final fatal insight into his character. Eddie was all the more delicate because he sometimes suspected he was not delicate at all. Eddie needed to be protected from his own dim intimations of possible bravery.
On rainy days, Myra always took his rubbers out of the plastic bag in the closet and put them by the coat rack next to the door. Beside his plate of unbuttered wheat toast each morning was a dish of what might have been taken at a casual glance for a multicolored pre-sweetened children's cereal, but which a closer look would have revealed to be a whole spectrum of vitamins, most of which Eddie had in his medicine bag right now. Myra, like Mother, understood, and there had really been no chance for him. As a young unmarried man, he had left his mother 3 times and returned home to her 3 times. Then, 4 years after his mother had died in the front hall of her queen's apartment, blocking the front door so completely with her bulk that the med-Q guys, called by the people downstairs when they heard the monstrous thud of Mrs. Kasprak going down for the final count, had had to break in through the locked door between the apartment's kitchen and the service stairwell, he had returned home for a 4th and final time. At least he had believed then it was for the final time. Home again, jiggity jog. Home again with Myra the hog. A hog she was, but she was a sweet hog, and he loved her. And there had really been no chance for him at all. She had drawn him to her with the fatal, hypnotizing snake's eyes of understanding. Home again forever, he had thought then. But maybe I was wrong, he thought. Maybe this isn't home, nor ever was. Maybe home is where I have to go tonight. Home is the place where, when you go there, you have to finally face the thing in the dark. He shuddered helplessly, as if he had gone outside without his rubbers and caught a terrible chill. Eddie, please. She was beginning to weep again. Tears were her final defense, just as they had always been his mother's. The soft weapon which paralyzes, which turns kindness and tenderness into fatal chinks in one's armor. Not that he'd ever worn much armor anyway. Suits of armor did not seem to fit him very well. Tears had been more than a defense for his mother. They had been a weapon. Myra had rarely used her own tears so cynically. But cynically or not, he realized she was trying to use them that way now. And she was succeeding. He couldn't let her. It would be too easy to think of how lonely it was going to be, sitting in a seat on that train as it barreled north toward Boston through the darkness, his suitcase overhead and his tote bag full of nostrums between his feet, the fear sitting on his chest like a rancid Vicks pack. Too easy to let Myra take him upstairs and make love to him with aspirins and an alcohol rub, and put him to bed where they might or might not make a franker sort of love. But he had promised. Promised. Myra, listen to me, he said, making his voice purposely dry, purposely matter-of-fact. She looked at him with wet, naked, terrified eyes. He thought he would try now to explain, as best he could. He would tell her about how Mike Hanlon had called and told him that it had started again. And yes, he thought most of the others were coming. But what came out of his mouth was much saner stuff. Go down to the office first thing in the morning. Talk to Phil. Tell him I had to take off and that you'll drive Pacino. Eddie, I just can't, she wailed. He's a big star. If I get lost, he'll shout at me. I know he will. He'll shout. They all do when the driver gets lost. And I'll cry. There could be an accident. There probably will be an accident. Eddie, you have to stay home. For God's sake, stop it. She recoiled from his voice, hurt. Although Eddie gripped his aspirator, he would not use it. She would see that as a weakness, one she could use against him. Dear God, if you are there, please believe me when I say I don't want to hurt Myra. I don't want to cut her, don't even want to bruise her. But I promised, we all promised, we swore in blood. Please help me, God, because I have to do this. I hate it when you shout at me, Eddie, she whispered. Myra, I hate it when I have to, he said, and she winced. There you go, Eddie, you hurt her again. Why don't you just punch her around the room a few times? That would probably be kinder and quicker. Suddenly, probably it was the thought of punching someone around the room which caused the image to come. He saw the face of Henry Bowers. It was the first time he had thought of Bowers in years, and it did nothing for his peace of mind, nothing at all. He closed his eyes briefly, then opened them and said, You won't get lost, and he won't shout at you. Mr. Pacino is very nice, very understanding. He had never driven Pacino before in his life, but contented himself with knowing that at least the law of averages was on the side of this lie. According to popular myth, most celebrities were shitheels, but Eddie had driven enough of them to know it usually wasn't true. There were, of course, exceptions to the rule, and in most cases the exceptions were real monstrosities. He hoped fervently for Myra's sake that Pacino wasn't one of these.
Is he?
She asked timidly.
Yes, he is.
How do you know?
Demetrios drove him 2 or 3 times when he worked at Manhattan Limousine, Eddie said glibly. He said Mr. Pacino always tipped at least $50.
I wouldn't care if he only tipped me 50 cents, as long as he didn't shout at me.
Myra, it's all as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, you make the pickup at the St. Regis tomorrow at 7 p.m. and take him over to the ABC building. They're retaping the last act of this play Pacino's in. American Buffalo, I think it's called. 2, you take him back to the St. Regis around 11. 3, you go back to the garage, turn in the car, and sign the green sheet.
That's all?
That's all. You can do it standing on your head, Marty. She usually giggled at this pet name, but now she only looked at him with a painful childlike solemnity.
What if he wants to go out to dinner instead of back to the hotel, or for drinks, or for dancing?
I don't think he will, but if he does, you take him. If it looks like he's going to party all night, you can call Phil Thomas on the radio phone after midnight. By then, he'll have a driver free to relieve you. I'd never stick you with something like this in the first place if I had a driver who was free. But I got 2 guys out sick, Demetrios on vacation, and everyone else booked up solid. You'll be snug in your own bed by 1 in the morning, Marty. 1 in the morning at the very, very latest. I absolutely guarantee it.
She didn't laugh at absolutely either. He cleared his throat and leaned forward, elbows on his knees. Instantly, the ghost mom whispered,
Don't sit that way, Eddie. It's bad for your posture and it cramps your lungs. You have very delicate lungs.
He sat up straight again, hardly aware he was doing it.
This better be the only time I have to drive,
she nearly moaned.
I've turned into such a horse in the last 2 years, and my uniforms look so bad now.
It's the only time, I swear.
Who called you, Eddie?
As if on cue, light swept across the wall. A horn honked once as the cab turned into the driveway. He felt a surge of relief. They had spent the 15 minutes talking about Pacino instead of Derry and Mike Hanlon and Henry Bowers, and that was good. Good for Myra, and good for him as well. He did not want to spend any time thinking or talking about those things until he had to. Eddie stood up.
It's my cab.
She got up so fast she tripped over the hem of her own nightgown and fell forward. Eddie caught her, but for a moment the issue was in grave doubt. She outweighed him by 100 pounds. And she was beginning to blubber again.
Eddie, you have to tell me.
I can't. There's no time.
You never kept anything from me before, Eddie, she wept.
And I'm not now. Not really. I don't remember it all. At least not yet. The man who called is an old friend.
You'll get sick,
she said desperately, following him as he walked toward the front hall again.
I know you will. Let me come, Eddie. Please, I'll take care of you. Pacino can get a cab or something. It won't kill him. What do you say, okay?
Her voice was rising, becoming frantic, and to Eddie's horror she began to look more and more like his mother. His mother as she had looked in the last months before she died. Old and fat and crazy.
I'll rub your back and see that you get your pills. I'll help you. I won't talk if you don't want me to, but you can tell me everything, Eddie. Eddie, please don't go. Eddie, please. Please.
He was striding down the hall to the front door now, walking blind, head down, moving as a man moves against a high wind. He was wheezing again. When he picked up the bags, each of them seemed to weigh 100 pounds. He could feel her plump pink hands on him, touching, exploring, pulling with helpless desire but no real strength, trying to seduce him with her sweet tears of concern, trying to draw him back.
I'm not going to make it, he thought desperately.
The asthma was worse now, worse than it had been since he was a kid. He reached for the doorknob, but it seemed to be receding from him, receding into the blackness of outer space.
If you stay, I'll make you a sour cream coffee cake, she babbled. We'll have popcorn. I'll make your favorite turkey dinner. I'll make it for breakfast tomorrow morning if you want. I'll start right now, and giblet gravy. Eddie, please, I'm scared. You're scaring me so bad.
She grabbed his collar and pulled him backward, like a beefy cop putting the grab on a suspicious fellow who was trying to flee. With a final fading effort, Eddie kept going. And when he was at the absolute end of his strength and ability to resist, he felt her grip trail away. She gave one final wail.
His fingers closed around the doorknob. How blessedly cool it was. He pulled the door open and saw a checker cab sitting out there, an ambassador from the land of sanity. The night was clear. The stars were bright and lucid. He turned back to Myra, whistling and wheezing.
"You need to understand that this isn't something I want to do," he said. "If I had a choice, any choice at all, I wouldn't go. Please understand that, Marty. I'm going, but I'll be coming back."
Oh, but that felt like a lie.
When? How long?
"A week, or maybe 10 days. Surely no longer than that."
"A week," she screamed, clutching at her bosom like a diva in a bad opera. "A week, 10 days. Please, Eddie, please."
"Marty, stop, okay? Just stop." For a wonder, she did. Stopped and stood looking at him with her wet, bruised eyes, not angry at him, only terrified for him and, coincidentally, for herself. And for perhaps the first time in all the years he had known her, he felt that he could love her safely. Was that part of the going away? He supposed it was. No, you could flush the supposed. He knew it was. Already he felt like something living in the wrong end of a telescope. But it was maybe all right. Was that what he meant? That he had finally decided it was all right to love her? That it was all right even though she looked like his mother when his mother had been younger, and even though she ate brownies in bed while watching Hardcastle and McCormick or Falcon Crest, and the crumbs always got on his side, and even though she wasn't all that bright, and even though she understood and condoned his remedies in the medicine cabinet because she kept her own in the refrigerator? Or was it? Could it be that? These other things were all things he had considered in one way or another, at one time or another, during his oddly entwined lives as a son and lover and a husband. Now, on the point of leaving home for what felt like the absolutely last time, a new possibility came to him, and startled wonder brushed him like the wing of some large bird. Could it be that Myra was even more frightened than he was? Could it be that his mother had been? Another dairy memory came shooting up from his subconscious like a balefully fizzing firework. There had been a shoe store downtown on Center Street, the Shoeboat. His mother had taken him there one day. He thought he could have been no more than 5 or 6, and told him to sit still and be good while she got a pair of white pumps for a wedding. So he sat still and was good while his mother talked with Mr. Gardner, who was one of the shoe clerks. But he was only 5, or maybe 6. And after his mother had rejected the 3rd pair of white pumps Mr. Gardner showed her, Eddie got bored and walked over to the far corner to look at something he had spotted there. At first he thought it was just a big crate standing on end. When he got closer, he decided it was some kind of desk. But it sure was the kookiest desk he had ever seen. It was so narrow. It was made of bright polished wood with lots of curvy inlaid lines and carved doojiggers in it. Also, there was a little flight of 3 stairs leading up to it. And he had never seen a desk with stairs. When he got right up to it, he saw that there was a slot at the bottom of the desk thing, a button on one side, and on top of it, entrancing, was something that looked exactly like Captain Video's space scope. Eddie walked around to the other side, and there was a sign. He must have been at least 6, because he had been able to read it, softly whispering each word aloud. "Do your shoes fit right? Check and see." He went back around, climbed the 3 steps to the little platform, then stuck his foot into the slot at the bottom of the shoe checker. Did his shoes fit right? Eddie didn't know, but he was wild to check and see. He socked his face into the rubber face guard and thumbed the button. Green light flooded his eyes. Eddie gasped. He could see a foot floating inside a shoe filled with green smoke. He wiggled his toes, and the toes he was looking at wiggled right back. They were his, all right, just as he had suspected. And then he realized it was not just his toes he could see. He could see his bones, too. The bones in his foot. He crossed his great toe over his 2nd toe, as if sneakily warding off the consequences of telling a lie, and the eldritch bones in the scope made an X that was not white, but goblin green. He could see. Then his mother shrieked. A rising sound of panic that cut through the quiet shoe store like a runaway reaper blade, like a fire bell, like doom on horseback. He jerked his startled, dismayed face out of the viewer and saw her pelting toward him across the store in her stocking feet, her dress flying out behind her.
She knocked a chair over and one of those shoe-measuring things that always tickled his feet went flying. Her bosom heaved. Her mouth was a scarlet O of horror. Faces turned to follow her progress.
"Eddie, get off there!" she screamed. "Get off there! Those machines give you cancer! Get off there! Eddie! Eddie!"
He backed away as if the machine had suddenly grown red-hot. In his startled panic, he forgot the little flight of stairs behind him. His heels dropped over the top one, and he stood there, slowly falling backward, his arms pinwheeling wildly in a losing battle to retain his departing balance. And hadn't he thought with a kind of mad joy, "I'm going to fall. I'm going to find out what it feels like to fall and bump my head. Goody for me." Hadn't he thought that? Or was it only the man imposing his own self-serving adult ideas over whatever his child's mind, always roaring with confused surmises and half-perceived images, images which lost their sense and their very brightness, had thought or tried to think? Either way, it was a moot question. He had not fallen. His mother had gotten there in time. His mother had caught him. He had burst into tears, but he had not fallen. Everyone had been looking at them. He remembered that. He remembered Mr. Gardner picking up the shoe-measuring thing and checking the little sliding gadgets on it to make sure they were still okay, while another clerk righted the fallen chair and then flapped his arms once in amused disgust before putting on his pleasantly neutral salesman's face again. Mostly he remembered his mother's wet cheek and her hot, sour breath. He remembered her whispering over and over in his ear, "Don't you ever do that again! Don't you ever do that again! Don't you ever!" It was what his mother chanted to ward off trouble. She had chanted the same thing a year earlier when she discovered the babysitter had taken Eddie to the public pool in Derry Park one stiflingly hot summer day. This had been when the polio scare of the early 50s was just beginning to wind down. She had dragged him out of the pool, telling him he must never do that, never, never. And all the kids had looked as all the clerks and customers were looking now, and her breath had had that same sour tang. She dragged him out of the shoe boat, shouting at the clerks that she would see them all in court if there was anything wrong with her boy. Eddie's terrified tears had continued off and on for the rest of the morning, and his asthma had been particularly bad all day. That night he had lain awake for hours past the time he was usually asleep, wondering exactly what cancer was, if it was worse than polio, if it killed you, how long it took if it did, and how bad it hurt before you died. He also wondered if he would go to hell afterward. The threat had been serious, he knew that much. She had been scared, that was how he knew. So terrified. "Marty," he said across this gulf of years, "would you give me a kiss?" She kissed him and hugged him so tightly while she was doing it that the bones in his back groaned. "If we were in water," he thought, "she'd drown us both." "Don't be afraid," he whispered in her ear.
"I can't help it," she wailed.
"I know," he said, and realized that even though she was hugging him with rib-breaking tightness, his asthma had eased. That whistling note in his breathing was gone.
"I know, Marty."
The taxi driver honked again.
"Will you call?" she asked him tremulously.
"If I can."
"Eddie, can't you please tell me what it is?"
And suppose he did. How far would it go toward setting her mind at rest?
"Marty, I got a call from Mike Hanlon tonight, and we talked for a while, but everything we said boiled down to two things."
"It started again," Mike said.
"Will you come?" Mike said. "And now I've got a fever, Marty, only it's a fever you can't damp down with aspirin, and I've got a shortness of breath the goddamned aspirator won't touch, because that shortness of breath isn't in my throat or my lungs. It is around my heart. I'll come back to you if I can, Marty, but I feel like a man standing at the mouth of an old mine shaft that is full of cave-ins waiting to happen, standing there and saying goodbye to the daylight." Yes, my yes, that would surely set her mind at rest. "No," he said, "I guess I can't tell you what it is."
And before she could say more, before she could begin again,
"Eddie, get out of that taxi. They give you cancer."
He was striding away from her faster and faster. By the time he got to the cab, he was almost running. She was still standing in the doorway when the cab backed into the street, still standing there when they started for the city. A big black woman's shadow cut out of the light spilling from their house. He waved and thought she raised her hand in return. "Where are we headed tonight, my friend?" the cabbie asked. Penn Station, Eddie said, and his hand relaxed on the aspirator. His asthma had gone to wherever it went to brood between its assaults on his bronchial tubes. He felt almost well. But he needed the aspirator worse than ever 4 hours later, coming out of a light doze all in a single spasmodic jerk that caused the fellow in the business suit across the way to lower his paper and look at him with faintly apprehensive curiosity.
"I'm back, Eddie,"
the asthma yelled gleefully.
"I'm back, and oh, I don't know, this time I just might kill you." "Why not? Gotta do it sometime, you know. Can't fuck around with you forever."
Eddie's chest surged and pulled. He groped for the aspirator, found it, pointed it down his throat, and pulled the trigger. Then he sat back in the tall Amtrak seat, shivering, waiting for relief, thinking of the dream from which he had just awakened. Dream? Christ, if that was all. He was afraid it was more memory than dream. In it there had been a green light, like the light inside a shoe store X-ray machine, and a rotting leper had pursued a screaming boy named Eddie Kasprak through tunnels under the earth. He ran and ran. He runs quite fast, Coach Black had told his mother, and he ran plenty fast with that rotting thing after him. Oh, yes, you better believe it. You bet your fur. In this dream where he was 11 years old, and then he had smelled something like the death of time, and someone lit a match, and he had looked down and seen the decomposing face of a boy named Patrick Hochstetter, a boy who had disappeared in July of 1958. And there were worms crawling in and out of Patrick Hochstetter's cheeks. And that gassy, awful smell was coming from inside of Patrick Hochstetter. And in that dream, that was more memory than dream, he had looked to one side and had seen two school books that were fat with moisture and overgrown with green mold. Roads to Everywhere and Understanding Our America. They were in their current condition because it was a foul wetness down here. How I Spent My Summer Vacation, a theme by Patrick Hochstetter. I spent it dead in a tunnel. Moss grew on my books and they swelled up to the size of Sears catalogs. Eddie opened his mouth to scream, and that was when the scabrous fingers of the leper clittered around his cheek and plunged themselves into his mouth. And that was when he woke up with that back-snapping jerk, to find himself not in the sewers under Derry, Maine, but in an Amtrak club car near the head of a train speeding across Rhode Island under a big white moon. The man across the aisle hesitated, almost thought better of speaking, and then did.
"Are you all right, sir?"
"Oh, yes," Eddie said. "I fell asleep and had a bad dream. It got my asthma going."
"I see."
The paper went up again. Eddie saw it was the paper his mother had sometimes referred to as the New York Times. Eddie looked out the window at a sleeping landscape lit only by the fairy moon. Here and there were houses, or sometimes clusters of them, most dark, a few showing lights. But the lights seemed little and falsely mocking compared to the moon's ghost glow. He thought the moon talked to him. He thought suddenly, Henry Bowers. God, he was so crazy. He wondered where Henry Bowers was now. Dead? In prison? Drifting across empty plains somewhere in the middle of the country like an incurable virus, sticking up 7-Elevens in the deep slumberous hours between 1 and 4 in the morning? Or maybe killing some of the people stupid enough to slow down for his cocked thumb in order to transfer the dollars in their wallets to his own? Possible, possible. In a state asylum somewhere? Looking up at this moon, which was approaching the full, talking to it, listening to answers which only he could hear? Eddie considered this somehow even more possible. He shivered. I am remembering my boyhood at last, he thought. I am remembering how I spent my own summer vacation in that dim, dead year of 1958. He sensed that now he could fix upon almost any scene from that summer he wanted to. But he did not want to. Oh, God, if I could only forget it all again. He leaned his forehead against the dirty glass of the window, his aspirator clasped loosely in one hand like a religious artifact, watching as the night flew apart around the train. Going north, he thought. But that was wrong. Not going north, because it's not a train. It's a time machine. Not north. Back. Back in time. He thought he heard the moon mutter. Eddie Kasprak held his aspirator tightly and closed his eyes against sudden vertigo. 5. Beverly Rogan Takes a Weapon. Tom was nearly asleep when the phone rang. He struggled halfway up, leaning toward it, and then felt one of Beverly's breasts press against his shoulder as she reached over him to get it. He flopped back on his pillow, wondering dully who was calling on their unlisted home phone number at this hour of the night. He heard Beverly say hello, and then he drifted off again. He had put away nearly 3 6-packs during the baseball game, and he was shagged. Then Beverly's voice, sharp and curious.
What?
Drilled into his ear like an ice pick, and he opened his eyes again. He tried to sit up, and the phone cord dug into his thick neck.
Get that fucking thing off me, Beverly,
he said. And she got up quickly and walked around the bed, holding the phone cord up with tented fingers. Her hair was a deep red, and it flowed over her nightgown in natural waves almost to her waist. Horse hair. Her eyes did not stutter to his face to read the emotional weather there. And Tom Rogan didn't like that. He sat up. His head was starting to ache. Shit, it had probably already been aching, but when you were asleep, you didn't know it. He went into the bathroom, urinated for what felt like 3 hours, and then decided that as long as he was up, he ought to get another beer and try to take the curse off the impending hangover. Passing back through the bedroom on his way to the stairs, a man in white boxer shorts that flapped like sails below his considerable belly, his arms like slabs, he looked more like a dock walloper than the president and general manager of Beverly Fashions, Inc. He looked over his shoulder and yelled crossly, "If it's that bull dyke Leslie, tell her to go eat out some model and let us sleep." Beverly glanced up briefly, shook her head to indicate it wasn't Leslie, and then looked back at the phone. Tom felt the muscles at the back of his neck tighten up. It felt like a dismissal. Dismissed by m'lady. M'fucking lady. This was starting to look like it might turn into a situation. It might be that Beverly needed a short refresher course on who was in charge around here. It was possible. Sometimes she did. She was a slow learner. He went downstairs and padded along the hall to the kitchen, absently picking the seat of his shorts out of the crack of his ass, and opened the refrigerator. His reaching hand closed on nothing more alcoholic than a blue Tupperware dish of leftover noodles Romanoff. All the beer was gone. Even the can he kept way in the back. Much as he kept a $20 bill folded up behind his driver's license for emergencies, was gone. The game had gone 14 innings and all for nothing. The White Sox had lost. Bunch of candy asses this year. His eyes drifted to the bottles of hard stuff on the glassed-in shelf over the kitchen bar, and for a moment he saw himself pouring a splash of Beam over a single ice cube. Then he walked back toward the stairs, knowing that was asking for even more trouble than his head was currently in. He glanced at the face of the antique pendulum clock at the foot of the stairs and saw it was past midnight. This intelligence did nothing to improve his temper, which was never very good even at the best of times. He climbed the stairs with slow deliberation, aware, too aware, of how hard his heart was working. Kaboom, ka-thud, kaboom, ka-thud, kaboom, ka-thud. It made him nervous when he could feel his heart beating in his ears and wrists as well as in his chest. Sometimes when that happened, he would imagine it not as a squeezing and loosening organ, but as a big dial on the left side of his chest with the needle edging ominously into the red zone. He did not like that shit. He did not need that shit. What he needed was a good night's sleep. But the numb cunt he was married to was still on the phone.
I understand that, Mike. Yes, yes. I am. I know. But...
A longer pause.
Bill Denbro?
She exclaimed, and that ice pick drilled into his ear again. He stood outside the bedroom door until he got his breath back. Now it was ka-thud, ka-thud, ka-thud again. The booming had stopped. He briefly imagined the needle edging out of the red and then willed the picture away. He was a man, for Christ's sake, and a damned good one, not a furnace with a bad thermostat. He was in great shape, he was iron, and if she needed to relearn that, he would be happy to teach her. He started in, then thought better of it and stood where he was a moment longer, listening to her, not particularly caring about who she was talking to or what she said, only listening to the rising, falling tones of her voice. And what he felt was the old familiar dull rage. He had met her in a downtown Chicago singles bar 4 years ago. Conversation had been easy enough because they both worked in the Standard Brands building and knew a few of the same people. Tom worked for King and Landry Public Relations on 42. Beverly Marsh, so she had been then, was an assistant designer at Delia Fashions on 12. Delia, which would later enjoy a modest vogue in the Midwest, catered to young people. Delia skirts and blouses and shawls and slacks were sold largely to what Delia Castleman called youth stores and what Tom called head shops. Tom Rogan knew two things about Beverly Marsh almost at once. She was desirable and she was vulnerable. In less than a month, he knew a third as well. She was talented, very talented. In her drawings of casual dresses and blouses, he saw a money machine of almost scary potential. Not in the head shops, though, he thought, but did not say. At least not then. No more bad lighting, no more knockdown prices, no more shitty displays somewhere in the back of the store between the dope paraphernalia and the rock group t-shirts. Leave that shit for the small-timers. He had known a great deal about her before she knew he had any real interest in her, and that was just the way Tom wanted it. He had been looking for someone like Beverly Marsh all his life, and he moved in with the speed of a lion making a run at a slow antelope. Not that her vulnerability showed on the surface. You looked and saw a gorgeous woman, slim but abundantly stacked. Hips weren't so great, maybe, but she had a great ass and the best set of tits he had ever seen. Tom Rogan was a tit man, always had been, and tall girls almost always had disappointing tits. They wore thin shirts and their nipples drove you crazy. But when you got those thin shirts off, you discovered that nipples were really all they had. The tits themselves looked like the pull knobs on a bureau drawer. More than a handful's wasted, his college roommate had been fond of saying. But as far as Tom was concerned, his college roommate had been so full of shit he squeaked going into a turn. Oh, she had been some kind of fine-looking, all right, with that dynamite body and that gorgeous fall of red wavy hair. But she was weak. Weak somehow. It was as if she was sending out radio signals which only he could receive. You could point to certain things, how much she smoked, but he had almost cured her of that. The restless way her eyes moved, never quite meeting the eyes of whoever was talking to her, only touching them from time to time and then leaping nimbly away. Her habit of lightly rubbing her elbows when she was nervous, the look of her fingernails, which were kept neat but brutally short. Tom noticed this latter the first time he met her. She picked up her glass of white wine, he saw her nails and thought, she keeps them short like that because she bites them. Lions may not think, at least not the way people think, but they see. And when antelopes start away from a waterhole, alerted by that dusty rug scent of approaching death, the cats can observe which one falls to the rear of the pack. Maybe because it has a lame leg, maybe because it is just naturally slower, or maybe because its sense of danger is less developed. And it might even be possible that some antelopes, and some women, want to be brought down. Suddenly he heard a sound that jerked him rudely out of these memories. The snap of her cigarette lighter. The dull rage came again. His stomach filled with a heat which was not entirely unpleasant. Smoking. She was smoking. They had had a few of Tom Rogan's special seminars on the subject. And here she was, doing it again. She was a slow learner, all right. But a good teacher is at his best with slow learners. Yes, she said now. Uh-huh. All right, yes. She listened, then uttered a strange, jagged laugh he had never heard before. Two things, since you ask. Reserve me a room and say me a prayer. Yes, okay. Uh-huh. Me too. Good night. She was hanging up as he came out. He meant to come in hard, yelling at her to put it out. Put it out now. Right now. But when he saw her, the words died in his throat. He had seen her like this before, but only two or three times. Once before their first big show, once before the first private preview showing for national buyers, and once when they had gone to New York for the International Design Awards. She was moving across the bedroom in long strides, the white lace nightgown molded to her body, the cigarette clamped between her front teeth. God, he hated the way she'd looked with a butt in her mouth. Sending back a little white ribbon over her left shoulder like smoke from a locomotive stack. But it was her face that really gave him pause, that caused the planned shout to die in his throat. His heart lurched, kabamp, and he winced, telling himself that what he felt was not fear but only surprise at finding her this way. She was a woman who really came alive all the way only when the rhythm of her work spiked toward a climax. Each of those remembered occasions had, of course, been career-related. At those times, he had seen a different woman from the one he knew so well. A woman who fucked up his sensitive fear radar with wild bursts of static. The woman who came out in times of stress was strong but high-strung, fearless but unpredictable. There was lots of color in her cheeks now, a natural blush high on her cheekbones. Her eyes were wide and sparkly, not a trace of sleep left in them. Her hair flowed and streamed, and, oh, looky here, friends and neighbors. Oh, you just looky right here. Is she taking a suitcase out of the closet? A suitcase? By God, she is. Reserve me a room, say me a prayer. Well, she wasn't going to need a room in any hotel, not in the foreseeable future, because little Beverly Rogan was going to be staying right here at home, thank you very much, and taking her meals standing up for the next 3 or 4 days. But she very well might need a prayer or two before he was through with her. She tossed the suitcase on the foot of the bed and then went to her bureau. She opened the top drawer and pulled out 2 pairs of jeans and a pair of cords, tossed them into the suitcase. Back to the bureau, cigarette streaming smoke over her shoulder. She grabbed a sweater, a couple of t-shirts, one of the old ship and shore blouses that she looked so stupid in but refused to give up. Whoever had called her sure hadn't been a jet setter. This was dull stuff, strictly Jackie Kennedy Hyannisport weekend stuff. Not that he cared about who had called her or where she thought she was going, since she wasn't going anywhere. Those were not the things which pecked steadily at his mind, dull and achy from too much beer and not enough sleep. It was that cigarette. Supposedly she had thrown them all out. But she had held out on him. The proof was clamped between her teeth right now. And because she still had not noticed him standing in the doorway, he allowed himself the pleasure of remembering the 2 nights which had assured him of his complete control over her. "I don't want you to smoke around me anymore," he told her as they headed home from a party in Lake Forest. October, that had been. "I have to choke that shit down at parties and at the office, but I don't have to choke it down when I'm with you. You know what it's like? I'm going to tell you the truth. It's unpleasant, but it's the truth. It's like having to eat someone else's snot." He thought this would bring some faint spark of protest, but she had only looked at him in her shy, wanting-to-please way. Her voice had been low and meek and obedient. "All right, Tom. Pitch it, then." She pitched it. Tom had been in good humor for the rest of that night. A few weeks later, coming out of a movie, she unthinkingly lit a cigarette in the lobby and puffed it as they walked across the parking lot to the car. It had been a bitter November night, the wind chopping like a maniac at any exposed square inch of flesh it could find. Tom remembered he had been able to smell the lake, as you sometimes could on cold nights, a flat smell that was both fishy and somehow empty. He let her smoke the cigarette. He even opened her door for her when they got to the car. He got in behind the wheel, closed his own door, and then said, "Bev?" She took the cigarette out of her mouth, turned toward him, inquiring, and he unloaded on her pretty good, his hard, open hand stroking across her cheek hard enough to make his palm tingle, hard enough to rock her head back against the headrest. Her eyes widened with surprise and pain, and something else as well. Her own hand flew to her cheek to investigate the warmth and tingling numbness there. She cried out, "Ow, Tom!" He looked at her, eyes narrowed, mouth smiling casually, completely alive, ready to see what would come next, how she would react. His cock was stiffening in his pants, but he barely noticed. That was for later. For now, school was in session. He replayed what had just happened. Her face. What had that third expression been, there for a bare instant and then gone? First the surprise, then the pain, then the nostalgia. Look of a memory, of some memory. It had only been there for a moment. He didn't think she even knew it had been there, on her face or in her mind. Now, it would all be in the first thing she didn't say. He knew that as well as his own name. It wasn't, "You son of a bitch." It wasn't, "See you later, Macho City." It wasn't, "We're through, Tom." She only looked at him with her wounded, brimming hazel eyes and said, "Why did you do that?" Then she tried to say something else and burst into tears instead. "Throw it out." "What? What, Tom?" Her makeup was running down her face in muddy tracks. He didn't mind that. He kind of liked seeing her that way. It was messy, but there was something sexy about it, too. Slutty, kind of exciting.
The cigarette, throw it out.
Realization dawning, and with it, guilt.
I just forgot, she cried. That's all.
Throw it out, Bev, or you're going to get another shot. She rolled the window down and pitched the cigarette. Then she turned back to him, her face pale and scared and somehow serene.
You can't... You aren't supposed to hit me. That's a bad basis for a lasting relationship.
She was trying to find a tone, an adult rhythm of speech, and failing. He had regressed her. He was in this car with a child. Voluptuous and sexy as hell, but a child.
Can't and aren't are two different things, Keed, he said.
He kept his voice calm, but inside he was jittering and jiving. And I'll be the one to decide what constitutes a lasting relationship and what doesn't. If you can live with that, fine. If you can't, you can take a walk. I won't stop you. I might kick you once in the ass as a going-away present, but I won't stop you. It's a free country. What more can I say?
Maybe you've already said enough, she whispered.
And he hit her again, harder than the first time, because no broad was ever going to smart off to Tom Rogan. He would pop the Queen of England if she cracked smart to him. Her cheek banged the padded dashboard. Her hand groped for the door handle and then fell away. She only crouched in the corner like a rabbit, one hand over her mouth, her eyes large and wet and frightened. Tom looked at her for a moment, and then he got out and walked around the back of the car. He opened her door. His breath was smoke in the black, windy November air, and the smell of the lake was very clear.
You want to get out, Bev? I saw you reaching for the door handle, so I guess you must want to get out.
Okay, that's all right. I asked you to do something, and you said you would. Then you didn't. So you want to get out?
Come on, get out. What the fuck, right? Get out. You want to get out?
No, she whispered.
What? I can't hear you.
No, I don't want to get out, she said a little louder.
What? Those cigarettes giving you emphysema? If you can't talk, I'll get you a fucking megaphone. This is your last chance, Beverly. You speak up so I can hear you. Do you want to get out of this car, or do you want to come back with me?
Want to come back with you, she said, and clasped her hands on her skirt like a little girl. She wouldn't look at him. Tears slipped down her cheeks.
All right, he said. Fine. But first you say this for me, Bev. You say, I forgot about smoking in front of you, Tom.
Now she looked at him, her eyes wounded, pleading, inarticulate.
You can make me do this, her eyes said, but please don't.
Don't, I love you. Can't it be over?
No, it could not, because that was not the bottom of her wanting, and both of them knew it.
Say it.
I forgot about smoking in front of you, Tom.
Good. Now say, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, she repeated dully.
The cigarette lay smoking on the pavement like a cut piece of fuse. People leaving the theater glanced over at them, the man standing by the open passenger door of a late model fade into the woodwork Vega, the woman sitting inside, her hands clasped primly in her lap, her head down, the dome light outlining the soft fall of her hair in gold. He crushed the cigarette out. He smeared it against the blacktop.
Now say, I'll never do it again without your permission.
I'll never... Her voice began to hitch.
Never... Say it, Bev.
Never to do it again without your permission. So he had slammed the door and gone back around to the driver's seat. He got behind the wheel and drove them back to his downtown apartment. Neither of them said a word. Half the relationship had been set in the parking lot. The second half was set 40 minutes later in Tom's bed. She didn't want to make love, she said. He saw a different truth in her eyes and the strutty cock of her legs, however, and when he got her blouse off, her nipples had been rock hard. She moaned when he brushed them and cried out softly when he suckled first one and then the other, kneading them restlessly as he did so. She grabbed his hand and thrust it between her legs.
I thought you didn't want to, he said,
and she turned her face away. But she did not let go of his hand, and the rocking motion of her hips actually speeded up. He pushed her back in the bed, and now he was gentle, not ripping her underwear, but removing it with a careful consideration that was almost prissy. Sliding into her was like sliding into some exquisite oil. He moved with her, using her but letting her use him as well, and she came the first time almost at once, crying out and digging her nails into his back. Then they rocked together in long, slow strokes, and somewhere in there he thought she came again. Tom would get close, and then he would think of White Sox batting averages or who was trying to undercut him for the Chesley account at work, and he would be okay again. Then she began to speed up, her rhythm finally dissolving into an excited bucking. He looked at her face, the raccoon ringlets of mascara, the smeared lipstick, and he felt himself suddenly shooting deliriously toward the edge. She jerked her hips up harder and harder. There had been no beer gut between them in those days, and their bellies clapped hands in a quickening beat. Near the end, she screamed and then bit his shoulder with her small, even teeth.
"How many times did you come?" he asked her after they had showered.
She turned her face away, and when she spoke, her voice was so low he almost couldn't hear her.
"That isn't something you're supposed to ask."
"No. Who told you that, Mr. Rogers?"
He took her face in one hand, thumb pressing deep into one cheek, fingers pressing into the other, palm cupping her chin in between.
"You talk to Tom," he said. "You hear me, Bev? Talk to Papa."
"3,
she said reluctantly.
"Good," he said. "You can have a cigarette."
She looked at him distrustfully, her red hair spread over the pillows, wearing nothing but a pair of hip-hugger panties. Just looking at her that way got his motor turning over again. He nodded.
"Go on," he said. "That's all right."
They had been married in a civil ceremony 3 months later. Two of his friends had come. The only friend of hers to attend had been Kay McCall, whom Tom called that titsy women's lib bitch. All of these memories went through Tom's mind in a space of seconds, like a speeded-up piece of film, as he stood in the doorway watching her. She had gone on to the bottom drawer of what she sometimes called her weekend bureau, and now she was tossing underwear into the suitcase. Not the sort of stuff he liked, the slippery satins and smooth silks. This was cotton stuff, little girl stuff, most of it faded and with little puffs of popped elastic on the waistbands. A cotton nightie that looked like something out of Little House on the Prairie. She poked in the back of this bottom drawer to see what else might be lurking in there. Tom Rogan, meanwhile, moved across the shag rug toward his wardrobe. His feet were bare and his passage noiseless as a puff of breeze.
It was the cigarette. That was what had really gotten him mad.
It had been a long time since she had forgotten that first lesson. There had been other lessons to learn since, a great many. And there had been hot days when she had worn long-sleeved blouses or even cardigan sweaters buttoned all the way to the neck. Gray days when she had worn sunglasses. But that first lesson had been so sudden and fundamental. He had forgotten the telephone call that had wakened him out of his deepening sleep. It was the cigarette. If she was smoking now, then she had forgotten Tom Rogan. Temporarily, of course, only temporarily, but even temporarily was too damned long. What might have caused her to forget didn't matter. Such things were not to happen in his house for any reason. There was a wide black strip of leather hanging from a hook inside the closet door. There was no buckle on it. He had removed that long ago. It was doubled over at one end where a buckle would have gone, and this doubled over section formed a loop into which Tom Rogan now slipped his hand.
"Tom, you've been bad,"
his mother had sometimes said. Well,
sometimes was maybe not such a good word. Maybe often would have been a better one. "You come here, Tommy. I got to give you a weapon."
His life as a child had been punctuated by weapons. He had finally escaped to Wichita State College, but apparently there was no such thing as a complete escape, because he continued to hear her voice in dreams.
"Come here, Tommy. I got to give you a weapon. Weapon."
He had been the eldest of four. 3 months after the youngest had been born, Ralph Rogan had died. Well, died was maybe not such a good word. Maybe committed suicide would have been a better way to put it, since he had poured a generous quantity of lye into a tumbler of gin and quaffed this devil's brew while sitting on the bathroom hopper. Mrs. Rogan had found work at the Ford plant. Tom, although only 11, became the man of the family. And if he screwed up, if the baby shat her dighties after the sitter went home and the mess was still in them when Mom got home, if he forgot to cross Megan on the Broad Street corner after her nursery school got out and that nosy Mrs. Gant saw,
if he happened to be watching American Bandstand while Joey made a mess in the kitchen,
If any of those things or 1,000 others happened, then, after the smaller children were in bed, the spanking stick would come out and she would call the invocation.
Come here, Tommy. I got to give you a weapon.
Better to be the whupper than the whupped. If he had learned nothing else on the great toll road of life, he had learned that. So he flipped the loose end of the belt over once and pulled the loop snug. Then he closed his fist over it. It felt good. It made him feel like a grown-up. The strip of leather hung from his clenched fist like a dead black snake. His headache was gone. She had found that one last thing in the back of the drawer, an old white cotton bra with gunshell cups. The thought that this early morning call might have been from a lover surfaced briefly in his mind and then sank again. That was ridiculous. A woman going away to meet her lover did not pack her faded ship and shore blouses and her cotton K-mark undies with the pops and snarls and the elastic. Also, she wouldn't dare.
Beverly, he said softly, and she turned at once, startled, her eyes wide, her long hair swinging.
The belt hesitated, dropped a little. He stared at her, feeling that little bloom of uneasiness again. Yes, she had looked this way before the big shows, and then he hadn't gotten in her way. Understanding that she was so filled with a mixture of fear and competitive aggressiveness that it was as if her head was full of illuminating gas. A single spark and she would explode. She had seen the shows not as a chance to split off from Delia Fashions to make a living, or even a fortune, on her own. If that had been all, she would have been fine. But if that were all, she also would not have been so ungodly talented. She had seen those shows as a kind of super exam on which she would be graded by fierce teachers. What she saw on those occasions was some creature without a face. It had no face, but it did have a name. Authority. All of that wide-eyed nerviness was on her face now. But not just there. It was all around her, an aura that seemed almost visible, a high-tension charge which made her suddenly both more alluring and more dangerous than she had seemed to him in years. He was afraid because she was here, all here, the essential she as apart from the she Tom Rogan wanted her to be, the she he had made. Beverly looked shocked and frightened. She also looked almost madly exhilarated.